Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's all online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's betterhelp.com.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, as the French election campaign launches, what are the risks for the French economy of a far-right government? Also, China's premier on a visit to Australia to try to repair a fractured relationship that's caused major problems for trade. Meanwhile, China seems poised to impose tariffs on EU pork. Is this just retaliation for the tariffs on Chinese electric cars? And wish you weren't here. We'll have a report from the places where tourism is a curse as well as a blessing.
The main things they're saying is please put a stop to any more hotel developments.
That's all coming up on World Business Report. But first, in France, the campaign has now officially begun in the snap parliamentary election called by President Macron. Opinion polls suggest the far-right National Rally will win the most seats, with President Emmanuel Macron's centrist alliance coming third. The National Rally, which has already said it would slash VAT on energy and lower the retirement age, is set to lay out its full economic programme in the coming days. Meanwhile, the captain of France's national football team, Kylian Mbappe, has called on young people to make sure that they vote, and he also made what seemed a jab at the National Rally.
We know that we're at a very important moment in the history of our country, an unprecedented situation. That's why I really want to address the French people and especially the younger generation. I think we, as a generation, can make a difference. We see today that the extremists are at the gates of power.
The words of Kylian Mbappe there. Well, the rise of the far right in what is the Eurozone's second biggest economy has sent jitters through financial markets. France got a downgrade on its creditworthiness earlier this month from Standard & Poor's rating agency, which pointed to political fragmentation as a danger. So what is at stake in the French economy? Joining me now is the French economist Thomas Piketty, author of Capital in the 21st Century and A Brief History of Equality. He's also professor of economics at the School for Advanced Studies in the Social Sciences and associate chair at the Paris School of Economics. Thomas, welcome to the programme and thanks for being with us. First of all, what do you think are the risks of a far-right government, the parliament being dominated by the far-right, as far as France's economy is concerned?
Well, first, I think it's going to be a very close election, and basically it's going to be a race between the nationalist bloc on the right and the left bloc, sort of social ecological bloc on the left. And frankly, I don't think the nationalist bloc is going to get an absolute majority of the seat. If they come first, it will be only a relative majority. And in fact, I think there's a high chance that the left bloc comes first in terms of relative majority. What we are sure about and what we have seen in the European election is a fall of the sort of pro-business centrist bloc that Macron has put together now 7 years ago. And, you know, I think the reason for this fall is enormous disappointment of the population with Macron and maybe more precisely the fact that this electoral bloc always wanted to present itself as a sort of block of reason against everybody else was supposed to be an extremist as compared to this centrist block of reason. But in practice, if you look at who voted for this block, including in the most recent election, it was mostly, you know, higher income groups, relatively old electorate. And, you know, you cannot govern a country simply by appealing to the, you know, the people with the highest income. It was a very fragile coalition to begin with.
Yes, indeed. And that may be part of the reason for where it's going. But what about the consequences of this? Because we've already seen the bond market very spooked about the possibility, whether it's of, as you say, going further to the left or further to the right. Does this actually cause a threat to the French economy? Because it's already heavily indebted, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But, you know, it's not more indebted than after World War II. It's not more indebted than after World War I. It's not more indebted than at the time of the French Revolution. So, you know, we've had lots of, you know, episodes with large public debt in the past, you know, in particular after World War II. And, you know, what we've seen after World War II is an episode of reconstruction. So, you know, the challenges that we have today are not the same.
Marshall Plan there in Europe after the war. Situation now.
No, that's not Marshall Plan. It's not relevant here to get rid of the French public debt or German public debt after World War II. This was done through domestic policy decisions, you know, basically to get rid of the...
But there was financial underpinning for the economy. And my point is that at the moment, you have a clear crisis of confidence in the French economy markets.
Let me tell you, you know, the fundamental underpinning of the economy were much more complicated at the time where basically Germany and France were destroyed than they are today. So there are serious challenges today, very serious challenges with respect to climate change, but there are solutions. And, you know, I think... the illusion of a political system with a sort of pro-business center governing forever on the basis of the division between the left and the right opposition, you know, I think this was an illusion. I think democracy and electoral democracy, democratic pluralism requires to have alternative. And I think, you know, an alternative between the right and the left, you know, is the best way we have found historically, in particular in the post-World War II period, you know, to have, useful democratic conversation and, you know, you elect someone, you try them, then you go to the other one.
That is looking to the longer term. In the initial period, you have a situation of high debt, I mean, maybe not historically high, but high, and you have a crisis of confidence in the international money markets, which means that France can't borrow as easily, which is what it will need in order to do the things that you want to do.
Yeah, you know, don't worry too much about the public debt. You know, look at the interest rate, Eurozone bonds right now. You know, they are still below inflation. They are historically extremely low because, you know, you have a lot of saving around the world who are looking for where to go. And you know, after all, France or Germany, you know, as compared to putting your money in Brazil or Russia or China or Indonesia, looks relatively safe. So, you know, I don't think these are really the deep issues we should look at. What we should look at today and what's interesting in the French election is that the nationalist bloc is really turning to the right in terms of economic and fiscal policy. So, you know, the Rassemblement National, National Rally Bloc is now turning to other parties on the right, you know, including Eric Ciotti, the leader of Les Républicains, the sort of former center-right party, or to Marion Maréchal and Eric Zemmour, you know, the Reconquête Party, who are very economically liberal. Basically, they want to slash public sector jobs, they want to slash taxes. And, you know, I think that's an interesting evolution.
What about the age of retirement, which has been a huge issue, the pension age in France? They've talked about pushing it further back down beyond 64, people younger than that. Do you think that would happen or not?
Okay, so what you need to have in mind is that in order to have a full pension in France, you know, there are two conditions. One is the age, so there is a discussion about 64, 62. But the other condition, which is much more important, is the number of years of contribution, which is now 43. And the two conditions need to be met. So for people who go to university, you know, who start working at, say, at least 22 or 23 or 24, you need to add 43 years of contribution. So it's going to be 65, 66, 67. So when we're talking When there's a discussion in France about getting the age down from 64 to 62, in fact, this will be binding only for people who have started to work very early, say at age 18. And the question is, if you have started to work very early, say at age 18, if you need to wait until age 64, then you need to contribute 46 years, you know, whereas people who have had university studies only need to work 42, 42. So we have, you know, on this
I see your point.
To be very precise, otherwise, but we make people believe that, you know, everybody is going to retire at 62 or 60 in France, which is obviously wrong and which nobody is proposing.
Okay, Thomas, let me ask you finally and briefly, if you very, very briefly, if you would, do you think then that the Rassemblement National will not be as right-wing or as it pretends in terms of its future development if it holds the balance of power?
No, it will be very right-wing, especially on, you know, anti-migrant, anti-Islam policy. I think they will not solve the problem, you know, the social problems, the economic problems, the housing problems, the climate problems that we have to solve. And I think it will be a huge disappointment. Now, is this a reason to give them a try? No, I don't think this is a reason to give them a try. And I think there's a good chance that, again, they will finish second and that the first block in the next assembly will be the block from
the
left.
Thomas, thank you so much for being with us. Thomas Piketty there, his view on the French election campaign, which, of course, kicks off today. Well, let's now reflect on some of that, perhaps, with Rachel Winter, partner at Killick & Co. It joins me now. Rachel, I mentioned there to Thomas Piketty about the problems in the bond market. I mean, there is a sense, some people are talking about a Eurozone crisis coming as a result of a potential power of the far right in France after the election.
There's certainly some nervousness. So often we say that markets don't like uncertainty, and we have got a very uncertain situation here in France at the moment. You talk about the bond market. We've also seen quite a sell-off in the equity market. So if we go back 1 week, the French market was the largest in Europe in terms of the value of the companies trading on it. Since then, we have seen a sell-off in some of those companies, and the French market at the moment is no longer the largest in Europe.
So that's welcome news to the FTSE, I suppose, in the
that's
UK.
That's true. Got to look on the bright side.
I guess. But overall, is there... In brief, you think a bit of a concern at the moment about the impact of the French election more generally?
There is. I think there is a concern. I think this snap election has been very unexpected. It has come as quite a shock. And I think markets and investors are really trying to adjust to that. And I think when things are quite uncertain, people would rather remove their money from the game and come back in when they know exactly what the situation is.
And I guess we'll find out about all that, of course, when the vote is in. It's quite a short election campaign, but we will be bringing you, of course, all the news about that when it happens. Rachel, stay with us. We'll come back to you in just a moment.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
17 members of Zambia's national football squad have been killed in an air crash. The players were on their way to Senegal for a World Cup game.
When disaster struck Zambia's national football team in 1993, many thought that was the end of the country's international football dreams.
These guys had a desire to take us to the World Cup.
The whole country was mourning.
Instead, it was the beginning of one of sport's greatest comeback stories.
We have to go on. We can't give up. We don't give up in Zambia.
Amazing Sport Stories from the BBC World Service presents the four-part series, Copper Bullets. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
A moment. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Well, let's turn our minds to Australia. Australia has China as a major trading partner and a regional neighbour, of course. But it's true to say that the relationship between Canberra and the world's second largest economy has not been smooth in recent years, and there have been a number of trade barriers on Australian exports. Australia's Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, touched on some of those problems at a meeting with the Chinese Prime Minister.
We also have our differences reflecting our different political systems, approaches and priorities. And that's why our candid dialogue is so important. For Australia, we consistently advocate the importance of a region and world that is peaceful, stable and prosperous, where countries respect sovereignty and abide by international laws.
And that candid dialogue he was talking about was taking place during the visit of the Chinese Premier Li Qiang on Monday. It's seen as very important for both sides, along with Beijing's declaration that relations are now on the right track. Trade between the two countries is at a record high level. Pandas are often a symbolic part of Chinese diplomacy. Mr. Li said a pair of new giant pandas will be sent to Adelaide Zoo. But I put it to Stephen Gidget, foreign affairs reporter at ABC Australia, this was about a lot more than pandas.
I guess what's at stake is the shape of a future relationship. And it's worth remembering that the Australia-China relationship has come off a really tumultuous and rocky 3 or 4 years. Listeners might remember back in 2020, Australia called for an investigation into the origins of COVID. That came after a series of decisions that had already frustrated and angered the Chinese government, including Australia blocking Huawei from our mobile network. And China responded by essentially putting Australia in the diplomatic deep freezer. All high-level contact was cut off. And then on top of that, we had a series of trade punishments levied on a range of Australian products, including beef, coal, barley, wine, the list goes on. Now, the impact of those sanctions in the end was actually pretty modest, not because they weren't hefty. It was some $20 billion in trade that was targeted, but because the vast bulk of those goods were diverted to other markets. But unsurprisingly, that experience with economic coercion has really shaped Australian attitudes over the following years. Now, what we've seen over the last 2.5 years or so is a slow thaw in the relationship, a process that the government in Australia has called stabilisation. And the visit today by Premier Li, the first time a Chinese premier has visited Australia for some 7 years, was sort of the culmination of that process of stabilisation. I guess the real question now is what follows next? What follows stabilisation? And the answer to that isn't yet clear.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, if this relationship, which you've described as being certainly difficult in the recent past and economic pressure put on it, is it possible that there will be new areas of economic cooperation going forward as well as restoring the old ones?
I think there quite possibly will be. And in fact, it's worth remembering Australia's bilateral trade with China is still chugging on very nicely indeed. It remains our biggest trading partner by a massive margin. If you take the next three countries after China, Japan, the United States and South Korea, you put them all together, it's still not cumulatively at the same level that China has. So it's a massively consequential trading relationship. Are there avenues for further cooperation? Yeah, absolutely, particularly in climate change. China, of course, has made enormous leaps and bounds in the clean energy space. Australia has been a bit more of a laggard. So there's definitely possibilities there. But even then, the strategic relationship impedes in interesting and complicated ways. For example, in critical minerals, Australia has got an awful lot of critical minerals. China would like to invest heavily in that sector. Australia is more wary because it wants to try and help the US and other countries set up alternative supply chains to those dominated by China because it fears Beijing using that domination as leverage down the course. So it's complex and it's fraught. Australia still wants to try and separate its strategic and military relationship from its trading ties with China. China, for a while, looked to be insisting that that wasn't possible. They said, look, you can't trade with us whilst being a strategic and military ally to the United States. It now seems to look increasingly like Australia can have its cake and eat it too. But there have also been some interesting concessions from Australia, not so much in what it's done, but what it has declined to do with China. For example, it's declined to sanction Chinese companies that have been involved in Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
And what about the Albanese government's attitude to these things? Because we know there are also, apart from the strategic relationships you've been talking about, there are also human rights issues that come up and I guess can derail things quite easily. Is the Albanese government, again, perhaps trying to avoid those kind of flare-ups?
I don't think they're trying to avoid them entirely. They're just trying to avoid them consuming the broader bilateral relationship. But, you know, Anthony Albanese, to be fair, has been very clear that he will raise in public and in private all of those human rights issues. He's been particularly vocal about Australians who have been locked up. Now, the sense you get is that the Chinese would like Australia to stop raising these issues entirely. Australia is not going to do that, but it's also determined that it's not going to allow these cases to define the bilateral relationship. The feeling is Australia simply has to be in the room. It has to maintain high-level contact. It's pointless to do anything else.
Stephen Gigic there of ABC Australia. Well, on the other side of the planet, meanwhile, another trade row with China seems to be getting worse. The European Union's been told Beijing is launching an anti-dumping investigation into pork products in the EU. Beijing says it's in response to complaints from China's own domestic producers about cheap European pork imports flooding the market. The action could result in tariffs. Well, last week, the EU decided to impose its own tariffs of up to 40% on Chinese electric vehicles. Some in the EU see this latest action as tit for tat for that. Eva Gocic covers pork and beef sectors in Europe for Rabobank. I asked her first about the size of the EU's pork trade with China.
China is actually the single biggest market for EU pork, representing over about 30% of total EU pork exports. So, yeah, we are quite reliant on China.
Yeah, I understand about $3 billion worth, pretty much, which is pretty huge.
Yes, yeah, it's huge. Although our dependency decreased over the past 2-3 years, so it's peaked in 2020 when our dependency was around 55-60% because China was demanding more pork as they were just recovering from the African swine fever outbreaks. But now, yeah, it's still a significant market.
And if there were some tariffs put on EU pork, how would that affect the trade?
Higher tariffs would or could actually deteriorate further the competitive position of the EU. We already see quite high prices in the EU for pork relative to other exporters such as US and Brazil. That is because our supply declined over the past 2 years. So if competitive position is affected, then also price levels, margins in the European pork supply chains can be affected as well.
So Europe might lose market share, in other words?
Yes, that's right.
And that would be very damaging, I guess, to many European economies. Which economies within Europe would be most vulnerable?
Well, if we are looking at the biggest exporters of pork in Europe, that would be Spain. And also they are supplying most of the products to China. And also the Netherlands, Denmark, France, those are also big exporters with large exposure to China.
Now, of course, talking of tariffs reminds us that, in fact, Europe has decided to impose tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles. Is this being seen as a tit for tat, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think so. I do think that that's the kind of the reason for this investigation.
Because what the Chinese say is that they have complaints from their own domestic producers of pork that this is unfair competition, but you don't think that necessarily is true?
I don't think so, because China is reliant on imports, on pork imports, because they have a self-sufficiency about 95%. So they are still relying on pork imports, and they are importing from Brazil, from US. Europe actually is their biggest supplier. But when you look at prices in Europe, those are quite high, and they are still importing products from the EU. And I don't think that we can go below our cost price levels because, yeah, it just wouldn't make sense for European exporters to sell cheaper than our production costs.
Eva Gocic there. Still with me is Rachel Winter, Killick & Co. Rachel, China very much in the economic headlines at the moment. And of course, it's actually had some interesting data on its own domestic economy in the last few hours. Just give us a sense of what it's telling us about where China is economically.
Well, it's been a very, very difficult couple of years for China. If we look at the MSCI China Index, it's still half the level of where it was back in 2021. So that just really shows how difficult the past couple of years have been for China. All of these tariffs are making things worse. And what's really concerning investors at the moment is the state of the property sector.
Yeah, and clearly they're not investing in it like they used to. And of course, that has caused numerous problems with companies like Country Garden, of course, and Evergrande. We've been covering that one. Rachel, thank you so much for being with us. Now, from Barcelona to Bali, higher fees and new rules are targeting what's seen as the uncontrolled influx of tourism to many of the world's hotspots. Tourism is, of course, big business for hotels, restaurants and airlines, but many locals in these areas feel economically left out, and that rapid surge has gone too far. Ed Butler's been exploring the perceived problem of what's now called over-tourism.
The sound of protests in Tenerife, in the Canary Islands, in mid-April. Local men and women blowing conches, carrying banners, proclaiming that the Canary Islands has its limits.
I am incredibly moved by how many people actually came out on that day.
This is Sharon Backhouse. She's a British-born businesswoman who runs Geo Tenerife. It's a travel and research company on the island.
I was there on the ground, and there was people from all walks of life, and the mood was extraordinary. Hundreds of thousands of people on the streets demonstrating, six people on hunger strike for 20 days. And one of the main things they're saying is, please put a stop to any more hotel developments until we can implement a model that is equally good for locals and not just foreign investors.
What we hope is that the demonstration will be historic. We're convinced it will be. The people are finally raising their voices. They're not going to stay at home.
People are frustrated that despite having these incredible, record-breaking tourism numbers, a third of the population is still at a risk of poverty and social exclusion. And what locals are saying is, look, we welcome tourism, we have for a long time, and we will continue to do so. But the locals have to be prime beneficiaries too.
Tenerife is not the first place to see such protests. Over-tourism, as it's known, the influx of camera-toting visitors into small areas of natural beauty, is being seen as a growing problem. They've prompted outcry in Machu Picchu in Peru, on Bali's sacred mountain, and from Egypt's pyramids to Mount Fuji in Japan. There, in one town, they've put up a wall to block the view of the mountain to deter the relentless photography.
We welcome foreigners for this revitalization of the community. But there are so many violations of basic manners, like jaywalking, dumping garbage, trespassing on people's property. I wish they'd pay more attention to that.
European cities, with their record-breaking visitor numbers, have become the epicentre of a growing anti-tourist sentiment now. Coco Owens is a professor of new urban tourism at In Holland University in the Netherlands.
First of all, there's the numbers of tourists. So many people on the streets. You can't move freely anymore. People drinking too much, being rowdy and that sort of thing. And then places have become more and more suitable for tourists rather than for residents. And in city centres you can see local supermarkets or local bakeries or other local facilities not being able to afford to rent anymore because there are tourist shops now.
Most tourist hotspots, of course, seek the economic benefits. But they are also coming up with different ideas to solve the excesses. Take Venice, which last month became the first city to charge tourists coming on day trips to enter the city. Simone Venturini is the city's deputy mayor for tourism.
Right now, Venice is trying to restart better than before. We just want less tourism in terms of quantity, and we want higher tourism in terms of quality. Not only to take a selfie in 3 hours and then go home, because this is not the right tourist for the city of Venice.
The issue of taxation is an interesting one because it's a relatively easy thing to do. But again, you need to be careful to only talk about the economic benefits. The economic benefits of tourism are relatively limited to a set number of stakeholders, people who work in tourism or who own a business, but most people do not fall into that category, whereas the disadvantages are felt by a much larger group of people.
Professor Coco Owens. The fact is, though, that for all of these ideas to reduce over-tourism, current projections suggest that global travel is going to carry on rising for the foreseeable future.
And that was Ed Butler reporting on the difficulties that some places have with the tourists that are attracted to them when there are too many of them. And you can hear more of his exploration into some of the ways cities are addressing over-tourism in today's edition of Business Daily, which you can download as a podcast wherever you normally get your podcasts. But be assured, you're always welcome at World Business Report, where I and the team have been bringing to you the latest business news. And we're back tomorrow. Bye-bye.
17 members of Zambia's national football squad have been killed in an air crash. The players were on their way to Senegal for a World Cup game.
When disaster struck Zambia's national football team in 1993, many thought that was the end of the country's international football dreams.
These guys had a desire to take us to the World Cup.
The whole country was mourning.
Instead, it was the beginning of one of sport's greatest comeback stories.
We have to go on. We can't give up. We don't give up in Zambia.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service presents the four-part series, Copper Bullets. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.